Israel's Supreme Court is set to rule on the planned eviction of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied Al-Quds. Calls are growing in the U.S. for the extension of the coronavirus-related ban on evictions that has expired, leaving millions of Americans homeless. Malaysian opposition lawmakers calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Mohiuddin Yassin over the postponement of a parliament session. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bashar Sajafi. Good to have you with us. Israel's Supreme Court is set to rule on the planned eviction of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied Al-Quds. The verdict could lead to forceful removal of Palestinians from their ancestral homes to make way for the regime to build more settler units. The ruling was delayed after the Attorney General requested more time to study the case in May. The plan sparked anger and protests, which met a crackdown by regime forces, leaving hundreds of Palestinians injured. Since the May clashes, Sheikh Jarrah has been blockaded by Israeli troops, which locals say amounts to a siege. The case has also captured global attention, with international rights groups accusing Tel Aviv of plotting to grab more land to hand them over to settlers. Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says that the hearing might be the last chance for the Palestinians to prevent the Israeli eviction plan for the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
At Monday's hearing, the Israeli court will hear a petition for leave to appeal filed by those four Palestinian families against orders evicting them from their homes for the benefit of the Settlers Association that claimed it had documents probing the ownership of the land these Palestinian homes were built on. So it could be the last chance to prevent the eviction. Palestinian families say they have all the required documents in order to prove their ownership. We are speaking about lands, Palestinian lands owned by Palestinians since even before the 1948. So all the Israeli settler claims are wrong, and they are trying to force the people leave their homes in Sheikh Jarrah in order to bring more settlers to live there, especially that Sheikh Jarrah is a Palestinian neighborhood, is located very close to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the old town of Jerusalem Al-Quds.
U.S. House Democrats have urged the administration of President Biden to immediately extend a nationwide ban on housing evictions that expired on Saturday. The request was made through a statement by Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other top Democrats. They urged the administration to extend a moratorium related to the coronavirus through October 18th. Biden had asked Congress to extend the deadline on Thursday amid surging Delta strain. But Congress failed to act after Republican House members blocked a Democratic-led bid. The House has already left for a six-week summer recess. It remains unclear whether the administration could extend the moratorium using executive powers. Over 15 million Americans are facing evictions as they are behind on their rental payments amid COVID restrictions. Meantime, top U.S. infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci is warning that the COVID situation in his country is set to get worse. He made the announcement in an interview with U.S. media while the country is grappling with a surge in the Delta strain. Fauci says 100 million people in America who are eligible to be vaccinated are not getting jabs, calling it an outbreak of the unvaccinated. Despite his warning, the official said that he doesn't think lockdowns are likely to return. More than 164 million people, or 50% of the U.S. population, is fully vaccinated. Infections, however, are soaring, especially in states with lower vaccination rates. Colin Campbell saying that many Americans are reluctant to get their COVID-19 jabs because they do not trust the U.S. government.
It's not necessarily so that there are 100 million vaccines, although there is a stockpile of vaccines that are waiting to be used. But those two can be mutually exclusive. What he's saying is there are still 100 million Americans who have not received a shot in their arm. Now, like I said, most likely they are available. We may have a stockpile that large, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the case. What it does mean, though, is that people would rather rely on their faith, maybe in religion, to resist getting COVID-19, that they don't trust the government in getting a vaccine because it was created so quickly, or because they may believe there's some other nefarious plot at hand here. There are those who believe that getting the vaccine could actually ruin their health rather than improve it or at least stave off the virus. We do have cases like Tuskegee experiment, for example, where they prevented giving black men medication that would keep away or at least decrease the symptoms of syphilis.
Australian troops have begun patrolling Sydney to enforce COVID lockdown rules as the country is struggling to contain the Delta strain. Some 300 unarmed military personnel began door-to-door visits in the city to ensure self-isolation and stay-at-home orders. The deployment was made at the request of state police after some defied lockdown rules and held protests. That after the authorities in New South Wales extended lockdown until the end of August, restrictions were implemented in mid-June after an outbreak of the Delta variant there. The state has reported more than 35,000 infections ever since. Queensland also extended a lockdown in Brisbane for another week after detecting 13 new cases in a day. And that's the biggest daily rise in the state since the pandemic started. In Malaysia, opposition lawmakers, angry at the postponement of parliament session, have marched on the legislative building to demand a resignation of Prime Minister Mohiuddin Yassin. The lawmakers chanted slogans against Mohiuddin, were stopped by police. Opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim delivered a speech accusing the premier of acting against the constitution. The parliament convened last week following months-long suspension due to a virus state emergency. Its final session on Monday was postponed with a notice citing detection of several COVID cases among attendees. The opposition, however, claims it was a politically motivated move to dodge a no-confidence vote. Mohiuddin is at the heart of the controversy since the king rebuked his government for misleading parliament over coronavirus laws. Public anger at the government's pandemic response has also led to protests and calls for the premier to quit. The United States and the UK have blamed Iran for a deadly attack on an Israeli-owned oil tanker off the coast of Oman without providing any substantial evidence. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has promised, quote, an appropriate response, claiming Washington is confident that Iran carried out the attack. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab also saying that the UK's assessments indicate that Iran had used a drone to target the tanker. And that follows a similar Israeli allegation. Tehran has strongly denied any involvement, rejecting the allegation as baseless. Tehran says it won't hesitate to defend its interests and national security. The strike on the vessel happened on Thursday, which left a British security guard and a Romanian crew member dead.
An Israeli petroleum products tanker managed by Israeli-owned Zodiac Maritime came under attack off the coast of Oman on Thursday. The London-based company later claimed that two crewmen, a Briton and a Romanian, had been killed in the assault. The US, Israel and their allies rushed to point the finger at Iran for the attack while the official investigation has only begun and is not completed yet. Meanwhile, a source close to the resistance axis said the attack on the Mercer Street tanker was a retaliation for Israeli aggression in Syria, particularly the latest attack on Dabbah Airport that left two resistance forces dead. In recent months, several other Israeli ships have been targeted in various maritime routes across the world. Earlier in the month, a fire broke out on an Israeli-owned cargo ship after it was struck by an unidentified weapon in the northeastern Indian Ocean. Back in February, an Israeli-owned ship was hit by an explosion in the Sea of Oman. In April, another Israeli ship came under attack off the coast of the UAE.
Resistance access won't permit Israelis to commit any crimes without retaliation, whether from the Yemen or Lebanon or Syria or Palestine or Tehran or any place of the resistance axis. So I guess they have to expect that the resistance forces can reach them anywhere. So they are playing a losing game with the resistance axis. whether when they attack at Syrian borders or the Iraq-Syrian borders or at Tehran when they commit assassinations or do any aggressions against this power. Now the balance of power is for the sake or for the interest of the access of resistance.
The retaliatory attack has exposed the vulnerability of Israeli entities in the region and sent a strong message to Israel that the resistance front will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity.
Israel has illegally bombed Syria for years. It's also carried out an assassination campaign against Iranian nuclear scientists and attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities. Yet there has been no action or even condemnation by the international community against Israel's sinister activities and plots. Its key ally, the U.S., is also occupying Syrian soil and selling its oil amid international silence. Now, in recent months, several Israeli ships have been targeted in various maritime routes across the world, but Tel Aviv is blaming Tehran for the latest attack on its ship and wants to pursue the case at the U.N.
Western countries have condemned the latest attack on the Israeli-owned ship off the Oman coast while they have always shut their eyes to Israel's crimes. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011, and millions more are suffering due to the crippling sanctions and economic war imposed on Syria by the U.S. government. That's why Washington's ally, the occupying regime of Israel, has attacked Syria on a continual basis. Also, the Syrian government blames the Israeli regime and its Western regional allies for aiding Takfiri terrorist groups wreaking havoc in the country. The latest attacks on Israeli ships come against the backdrop of Tel Aviv's various assaults on cargo ships across the Persian Gulf region and elsewhere. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. Israel is also responsible for several instances of acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program over the past decade, including attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of its scientists.
A root cause of the tension, the deplorable level of tension in the Middle East that the world has been witness to for many decades now, is the fact that Israel acts with impunity. Israel is given a blank check, so to speak, year on year from Washington and London to do as it pleases in the Middle East. If America and Britain truly respected international law, if they truly respected the Charter of the United Nations, and if they truly respected the concept of state sovereignty, then they would put an end to Israel's flagrant violations of international law.
The international community's silence in the face of Tel Aviv's crimes is a result of the U.S. shielding of the illegitimate regime of Israel. Tel Aviv has for long been able to get away with its crimes without any prosecution. However, the latest move by the resistance axis shows that Tel Aviv's hit-and-run tactic is no longer useful. Now, it must face the music and taste its own medicine.
Regional and Arab countries have reacted to the latest developments in Tunisia, that after President Kais Saied suspended the parliament and dismissed the government of Mr. Mashishi. Saied has held talks with the Algerian president and top diplomats from Libya, Morocco, and Saudi Arabia. Our correspondent has a report.
Tunisia's political crisis and rising tensions in the country have sparked reactions from countries across the globe. Tunisian President Kais Saied held a phone call with his Algerian counterpart Abdelmajid Tebboune and discussed the latest developments. Saied assured him that Tunisia is on the right path to establish democracy and that there will be important decisions soon. The Egyptian government has also said it is following with great interest what's happening in Tunisia and what authorities are doing there to achieve security and stability. Last week, the Tunisian president invoked emergency powers to seize control of the government, remove the prime minister, and freeze parliament.
The president used the provisions of the constitution and he respected the law. But some people in Tunisia say this was a coup. The president should respect the human rights and follow the constitution.
President Kais Saied has held meetings at the presidential palace with ministers of foreign affairs of Libya, Morocco, Algeria, and Saudi Arabia. They were briefed on the latest developments in Tunisia and affirmed their support for the Tunisian people and for the recent decisions of the president. Tunisian President Kais Saied also affirmed his commitment to bearing the trust and responsibility of protecting the country and confronting all attempts to strike and fragment it. The European Union has called for the resumption of Tunisian parliamentary activity as soon as possible. It also urged the political parties in Tunisia to respect the constitution and avoid violence.
Tunisian people are waiting for Saied to name a new prime minister to line out a roadmap after he invoked emergency powers. This will determine the next step and what lies ahead for the country's future. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
Friends, the Yellow Vest movement has taken to the streets again in many cities to protest, especially against the way that the government is organizing the vaccination campaign. Paris correspondent reports.
We are all against the health pass. That was the main slogan that brought together many protesters all over France. For the third week in a row, they continued marching against the government's decision to put in place a health pass for all citizens. This is an electronic document that every citizen has to show in public places that proves that they are vaccinated or have a negative PCR test. Medical figures are crystal clear. In European countries where the majority of its population is vaccinated, like the UK, the Netherlands, Denmark or Ireland, the COVID virus and its Delta variant are under control. So why are these protesters taking the street again? In hospitals, doctors say that the new wave of people with severe COVID symptoms are all non-vaccinated persons. In Martinique and La Réunion, two overseas French territories, a new lockdown has begun, given that very few people are vaccinated. The vaccination campaign has accelerated the last 3 weeks. In France now, more than 50% have received two jabs of the vaccine. So is it responsible to protest against these mandatory measures? 3,000 police officers have been mobilized to control all the marches today in the French capital. There were some clashes. It's amazing to see so many protesters on the street at the start of the holiday season. Some say that with these protests against the authoritarian measures of the French government, the Yellow Vest movement rose from its ashes. Despite clear indications that vaccination is effective in reducing symptomatic cases and deaths from COVID-19, protests continue in France, but rather against a mandatory health pass considered as a violation of individual liberties rather than against the vaccination itself. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Shopping is one of my favorite things to do. No matter where I go shopping, either in a big modern shopping mall or in an old market, I consider it really enjoyable. Today I'm going to visit a historical market in Tehran, Kuche Marvi. Kuche Marvi, literally Marvi Alley, is a historical alley and one of the oldest shopping centers of Tehran. Kuche Marvi is one of the must-see places in Tehran, which dates back to 200 years ago. In Kuche Marvi, some retail and wholesale products, including cosmetics, clothing, antiques, and food, are sold. Kuche Marvi is located near the Grand Bazaar of Tehran. There are several historical monuments in and around Kuche Marvi. Among them mentioned can be made of Shamsul Emare Edifice, Saraye Roshan Building, Marvi High School, Marvi Mosque, Saraye Mozaffarian, Marvi Old Bazaar, and Agha Mahmud Mosque. In the past, Arab migrants and Iranians who used to reside in Iraq did business in this bazaar. Therefore, elements of Arabic culture is visible in this alley. I am now at the beginning of Kuche Marvi. Here, there is a square with a beautiful statue at its core. This is the statue of a man pulling a cart with his kid. It's fantastic. I'd like to take a photo from it. At the beginning of Kuche Marvi, there is one of the oldest restaurants of Tehran which sells falafel. Falafel is a type of food which is popular in southern Iran, though its original form is Arabic. Oh, what an appetizing smell! First, I will eat a sandwich of falafel, and then I continue my market walking tour. In Kuche Marvi, it's like hitting two birds with one stone. You know why? You can both shop and at the same time enjoy seeing the historical monuments. All the stores have really beautiful and magnificent walls. Oh, my God! There are everything in these stores. Everything that you could imagine. Haberdashery shops next to cosmetic shops. Oh, food product shops. Different types of tea, coffee, chocolate. I will buy some Arabic coffee for my grandma at the end of my tour. Oh, look! An old tree! It is standing tall even after reconstruction of the alley. No damage to the tree. Great! It has been passed through the vaults. And I am now standing beside Aga Mahmud Mosque. This mosque belongs to Safavid era. Walking in this historical alley gives me a really good feeling. It's as if time has gone backwards, and I am walking in old Tehran. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Saudi regime-led coalition started its war on the Yemeni people, in 2014, with the hope of their bombing campaign and onslaught not taking more than a month or two to defeat them. Now, 7 years later, it is the Yemeni forces which have turned the tables and are now retaliating with its latest offensive on Mareb. Shocking the Saudi regime. Stay with us as we take a look at what it all means on this Spotlight. I'd like to start this off with our correspondent in Sanaa, Abdullatif Al-Washali. Abdullatif, fill us in on the latest situation of what is taking place.
Yes, thank you so much. The Yemeni army has successfully accomplished the second phase of Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation. Nata and Nu'man regions were fully liberated from the Saudi-backed terrorist groups in this operation. Almost 390 squared kilometers were liberated. The Yemeni army launched this operation and the first stage of this operation almost 2 weeks ago. The Yemeni army confiscated a huge number of weapons. They are US made according to military experts, and this is yet another proof of the US military support for the terrorist groups in Yemen, especially in Al Bayda, which is a new front to pressure the Yemeni army to limit its advances toward Marib city. The Minister of Defense today vowed the Saudi-led coalition and vowed all the other forces that they still have many surprises in case the war and the siege are still ongoing against the Yemeni people.
Thank you so much, Abdul Latif, for that update. And I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Brett Yonkers, historian and journalist out of Hausa, and Hossein Al-Bahati, journalist and political commentator out of Sana'a. I'd like to start it off with Brett, your perspective. What has happened that from the beginning of this war, the Saudis were basically expecting to breeze through it, and now they're on the edge of defeat?
I think this is a pretty typical case of imperial arrogance and imperial overstretch, as it is called, in which a nation that is used to being praised as a modern country, as a powerful power, as a power broker in the region, as one of the most, one of the absolute richest countries in the area, in the Arab world, and in fact, one of the richest countries in the world, of course, and of course, one with a state-of-the-art modern military, has to, whenever a country like that goes to war, of course, they have in their mind the idea that this will be fast, this will be easy, this should be no real issue, really. I often compare it a little to what happened in Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s, when, of course, the most powerful military in the world, the United States of America, went to war against what they saw as a backward Southeast Asian nation and got defeated, terribly defeated, in fact, by the Vietnamese resistance. And this is something that we have seen now. Of course, this war is still dragging on, and there is still a lot of room for changes in the future. Nobody really knows what the future will hold, of course. But the fact that we are now almost 7 years later and Yemen is still standing strong is by itself already a victory, because, as you mentioned, indeed, the Saudis and the Emiratis and their allies, they went to war in 2015 with the idea of being in Sana'a in a matter of weeks, in fact. And they have not done this. In fact, they have lost almost all control over the actual battlefield. They are sending Sudanese mercenaries. Now, recently, they are sending mercenaries from other East African countries. Mm-hmm. They are sending child soldiers to do the dirty fighting for them. But they are completely incapable of holding on to any real power on the ground. They are incapable of holding on to the central of Yemen, and even nowadays to the south. Even in Aden and Hadramaut, deep in the south of Yemen, which has been occupied for 6 years, they are losing control. And now, of course, when you see that Ma'arif is at the verge of being liberated by the Yemeni forces of the National Salvation Government in Sana'a, and when you see the operation of Nasr al-Mubin now happening in the province of Baida, this is all a massive propaganda failure, of course, for the Saudis. They are being defeated over and over and over again by a people who have nothing except for their tenacity and except for their dedication to their independence,
okay,
and their sovereignty.
All right, well, let me get Hossein in on this conversation. How have Ansarullah and Yemeni forces been able to be successful when there is a land, sea, and air siege on the country that's been implemented by the Saudis and allowed by their Western partners, such as the United States?
First of all, the Saudi blockade and total attacks and strikes that have killed maybe 20,000 Yemeni civilians, including many children, and the blockade has killed more than 300,000 Yemenis, most of them children, from severe malnutrition and from other diseases. This actually exposed the Saudi coalition backed by the United States that they actually don't want any peace for Yemen. They don't want Yemen to be free, and as well what they have done in the south. Saudi coalition claimed that the war against Ansarullah the Houthi is, as they say, to tackle down that coup and to bring Hadi legitimacy into Sana'a. But still, we've seen in the south that United Arab Emirates, they have created the so-called Southern Transition Council, which actually does not recognize Hadi government. They see the security situation in the south, how Al-Qaeda is running freely there, how Al-Qaeda is working side by side with Saudi and as well with the United Arab Emirates to fight the Houthi, and as well there are shortages of fuel, no security. I mean, everything there is upside down. That's why Yemenis actually has realized that this war actually is not about legitimacy, is about to bring Hadi to Yemen, Hadi, who is actually a puppet or a tool in the hand of Saudi and United States. And on the other hand, we see in areas under the control of Sana'a forces, there is well-tight security. Al-Qaeda has been eliminated from areas under the control of Sana'a. The only thing that Sana'a and areas under control of Sana'a government is the fuel shortages, food shortages, and this actually is because of the direct blockade. I just want to add that in the last 3 months since Biden has actually sworn as United States president, we have seen actually one of the largest fuel shortages in Yemen history, not only in during the 7 years of Saudi war, and this actually exposed that the United States, especially Biden, they want to use the weapon of blockade more against Yemenis. And one final thing, why Yemenis actually are successful, because Yemeni have actually relied on military equipment that they have. They actually upgraded their military equipment, and they stay resistant to fight Saudi, and they don't want to surrender or to give up towards Saudi coalition.
Well, Brett, I mean, we've heard from various UN agencies about the humanitarian suffering and disaster which is taking place in Yemen due to the siege and bombings, but we haven't seen much action. We've heard a lot of talk. Why is that the case?
Because this war is an extremely profitable business venture for a lot of Western nations, and especially, of course, their arms corporations. The Saudi war machine is oiled and supplied almost completely, of course, by the United States and by the United Kingdom and by France. These are, and in certain ways also by the Zionist entity of Israel, these are billions and billions of dollars that are spent by the Saudi regime every single year since 2015 in trying to keep up the war machine that they have built up. Like I said, it's a state-of-the-art war machine, but the problem is that the Saudis have shown themselves time and time again completely incapable of using this high-tech weaponry. So basically what they're doing is they're sending the best they have in terms of equipment into the battlefield in Yemen, where they lose it almost immediately, to sometimes makeshift weaponry, improvised explosives, or sometimes even due to the fact that the Yemeni forces, they chase away the drivers of the vehicles and then burn them by just using matches and petroleum. So the every time this happens, of course, the Saudis are in need of further military purchases. And aside from the obvious economic advantages this brings to these arms corporations in the West, there is the fact that this is it's a sort of propaganda war as well. Saudi Arabia has window dressed this entire conflict as a battle against what they call Iranian proxies, which is objectively untrue, because there is no Iranian influence, nor any Iranian troops have there ever been in Yemen. But this window dressing has been accepted as fact by the Western mainstream media. So if now they were to accept the fact that Saudi Arabia were to retreat and were to lose too easily, this can be constructed, can be perceived as a victory for Iran, which is, of course, a very easy victory for Iran, considering that Iran didn't actually have to do anything in order to win this propaganda victory, because they're not technically involved. But this is another reason, I think, why from a ideological viewpoint for the West, this is very important to keep this war going and to try to get as much as they can out of this conflict. Mm. The Saudis themselves, of course, have always had a very strategic objective and very strategic interest in this region. We're talking, of course, Yemen, which borders the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which borders the Red Sea connection that goes eventually to the Suez Canal and that way to the Mediterranean. And of course, the Arab Sea, which is the gateway into the Indian Ocean, the Indian subcontinent, and further into Asia. We already have said that in several southern and eastern Yemeni provinces, the ones that have been occupied by Saudi Arabia for going on 7 years now, there are massive oil pipelines that have been constructed already that will lead to port cities in Yemen that are occupied by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The goal of this is to make sure that Saudi Arabia can export oil, can pump oil from their own deserts and partially also from Yemen, straight onto the Yemeni coast, straight onto the Arabian Sea, and this way they can completely circumvent things like the Red Sea or the Persian Gulf, which of course for Saudi Arabia, it saves money, it saves time, and it would be an incredibly profitable, again, business venture that they are going for.
All right.
So for the entire thing, basically, the point is that for the West, it's all about money and about power in the end. They don't care about the humanitarian cost that this actually brings in the to the field in Yemen itself.
Okay. Well, Hossein, the latest offensive by the Yemeni forces is taking place in Ma'arib. And tell us about Ma'arib and why this particular offensive is so significant.
The latest offensive, as example, that took place in Al-Baida province, central Yemen. Yemeni army has controlled about 400 square kilometers, and those area were under a total control of Al-Qaeda, and is known that those one of the strongest or safe haven for Al-Qaeda. And when actually who opened that front is the Saudi-backed the Saudi coalition side by side with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, because they want to reduce the pressure on Ma'arib. They thought that Sana'a forces cannot fight in many front at one time, and what actually Yemeni army have shown here in Sana'a, that they are well equipped to attack anywhere, and they are well equipped as well to continue their attack to liberate Ma'arib. And I just want to say, we have seen the amount of outcry from the United States, United Nations, UK, and other countries who support this war against Yemen. They are crying out loud about the liberation of Ma'arib, and as well what happened in Al-Baida. We haven't, because they said of the civilians in Ma'arib, but they totally ignore when Saudi coalition were like maybe 20 kilometers east of Sana'a in Nahum. Nobody has said don't enter Sana'a, which have about 500 million Yemeni civilians. The attack against Hodeida, we didn't see any condemnation from the United Nations or UN or any other organization. This is actually because the United States want Yemen to stay a hub for Al-Qaeda. They have moved Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan to Iraq, to Syria, to Libya, and now they want to have a safe haven in this area, because they have almost lost the war against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and because Iraqi and Syrians have actually defeated Al-Qaeda, they want to have this hub, which Ma'arib actually now is have many hundreds of fighters from Al-Qaeda and ISIS who are fighting side by side. As well, there are four officials who work with Hadi government who are actually in the so-called treasury list of the United States for supporting Al-Qaeda. One of them is Al-Jouf governor, who have actually fled Al-Jouf when Sana'a force has liberated. And as well, the brother of the governor of Ma'arib, he is as well in that terrorist list. Hadi so-called advisor Al-Humaykani, he's from Al-Baida, he's in going in and out from Riyadh, he's on that list. And to show you exactly, United States is only using Al-Qaeda to fight and to create fight against Yemeni civilians like they did before.
Okay.
And they're using this crying out loud because they don't want Ma'arib to be liberated. And as well, Ma'arib have the oil field and gas field in the only place in Yemen. And Saudi actually is exporting millions of barrels since this war began against Yemen, because they want to support the war from revenue that comes from Yemeni oil.
Okay.
Because the economy has become really weak since the war started.
What about that, Brett? I mean, we have seen more of an outcry from various Western entities and television stations or networks in dealing with the situation of Ma'arib, as Hossein said, condemning it and talking about the humanitarian disaster that could take place. I mean, it just seems that more and more they're exposing their hypocrisy. Your assessment of it?
Well, of course, every time when you see Western pundits and Western news outlets report on situations like this, especially, of course, every time they talk about when the quote-unquote Houthis, so the forces of the National Salvation Government in Sana'a, are making progress, then suddenly, of course, the alarm bells are going off all across Europe and the West in general. And in many ways, this is similar to back in the day when the war was going on in Syria around Aleppo, when now as well still nowadays in the region of Idlib. Every time the Syrian Arab army says finally this is now enough is enough, all peace talks have failed, the rebels, the terrorist forces are still there on Syrian soil, and we want to do something about it. Every time the Syrian army finally moves forward, even after all these years of waiting and negotiating, Then suddenly, of course, the alarm bells are going off, and there are talks about how terrible the situation is and how horrible the Syrian Arab army is mistreating its own civilians. In some ways, this is similar in Yemen. Of course, it is different because the Yemeni National Salvation Government is not portrayed as a regime in the West, but they are portrayed as being the rebels, which by itself is ridiculous because they rule over the absolute majority of the Yemeni population and are the only of two governments that have any form of popular legitimacy in the eyes of the people themselves. But that's a different discussion, of course. But in aside from that, the reporting is similar. Whenever the National Salvation Government advances, like, for example, on Marib, they're saying there are reports in the West coming out and saying, oh, there's famine in Marib, there's problem in Marib, people are dying because of the shelling and because of the bombardments. And unfortunately, obviously, that is true. But what they failed to mention is that people have been starving in Yemen every single day for the past 6 to 7 years because of the Saudi blockade. They are trying, of course, in the West to pin it on different sort of things. They're pinning it on, they're making this, all both sides are bad story, or they're saying, you know, the Houthis are hogging all the humanitarian aid, the Houthis are destroying the food. They even tried to blame it on the cut, which is that herb that in Yemen that is a popular hunger suppressant, in fact, that people chew. In the West, they claim, like, because they are growing this crop, they are failing to grow enough food for themselves, etc., etc. So the amount, the extent to which this yellow page journalism, this propagandic journalism will go is absolutely unbelievable when you look at it from an objective viewpoint. But unfortunately, that is, of course, the situation we are in right now. And the reason why they're doing this, of course, is they're trying to play the humanitarian angle in order to justify the maintenance of the status quo. They've always been doing this. Every time a rebel or a revolutionary group pops up that fights against imperialism, that fights against tyranny, that fights against terrorism, these revolutionaries will be portrayed as the new terrorists. They will be portrayed as the ones who disturb the peace. Mm-hmm. There is no talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia is starving the country. No, they talk about the fact that the Houthis fail to surrender, that they refuse to give up. This is lies, basically, that are being spread over and over again. They have done it about Iraq, they have done it about Syria, they have done it about Iran, and now they're doing it about Yemen.
Okay.
Unfortunately, even when they talk about, you know, we should do something about the humanitarian situation, and when they do admit that Saudi Arabia is at fault, they immediately spin it into a both sides are bad story, and their solution will always be, oh, maybe we should negotiate some more, let's host another conference in Geneva or wherever, in order to talk this out without, of course, addressing the root
cause. All right, stay with me,
Brett.
Stay with me, please. Just a few minutes left. I got to get Hossein back in this. Hossein, how likely is it that the Yemeni forces will get total control of Marib? And what would that mean? Would we be seeing the beginning of the end of this terrible war, or your assessment?
I think if Sana'a forces liberated Marib, I think that the Saudi will not actually stop its war. And I believe that the United States after that will actually be directly involved in the war of Yemen. I expected they could send hundreds of troops to areas that's under the Saudi-led coalition control, because they know Marib and the control of Marib means that Sana'a forces are well equipped to liberate all Yemen, and the United States and Saudi doesn't want that. That's why I believe that if Yemeni forces will continue their attack, they shouldn't stop, and as well they should actually keep targeting Saudi Arabia, because in the last few months there was less attack against Saudi Arabia, and now given the Saudi and United States time, they could use they could enforce more blockade against Yemen. They have actually printed Yemeni riyals like in the last 7 years, more than what has been printed in the last 25 years. They show you that they want to now to target Yemen by their economy. The exchange rate for dollar here in Sana'a is half now what is actually in Aden, and they show you that here actually they are well equipped to fight the war, either economy by the economy or to fight politically, and as well the main attack against Saudi Arabia, I think it will stop this war. But if we continue just to liberate areas in Yemen without targeting Saudi Arabia, targeting their economy, this means that we give in Saudi time to enforce more types of blockade against Yemen.
All right, Hussein. Well, Brett, 1 minute. You think the retaliation must continue? And as Hussein, though, he talked about not only retaliation and defending inside of Yemen, but also offensive inside of Saudi Arabia. Your take, 1 minute.
Yeah, and if I need to say it in a short way, I think the Yemenis are definitely within the right to keep attacking, to keep counterattacking, and take back the rest of their country. And in fact, I believe Saudi Arabia should be very, very grateful if they can get out of this war by only having to pull back out of all of the Republic of Yemen. They should be very grateful if they can get to keep Jaizan, Nasran, and Asir, because these are regions of Greater Yemen that were stolen by the Saudis in 1934. But if they get to keep this, and if they, if the Yemenis allow them, allow the Saudis to keep this part of Saudi Arabia and do not reclaim it back for Yemen, the Saudis should be very, very fortunate, because that's the best possible outcome for them that they can still have in this war.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us here on the Spotlight. Brett Yonkers, historian and journalist out of House of Saud, and Hossein al-Bahati, journalist and political commentator out of Sana'a. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much, and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guests, Brother Ayman Rizvi and Ali Alevian. Assalamu alaikum to both of these dear guests.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, brother. So in the series of the program Viewpoints, we are mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei. One important topic which has been tackled by him on different occasions and his speeches is the position of human being and how important it is in Islam. We know that Islam has a type of special and specific look at the position of human being as the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's why when we are talking about human, we are not talking about the humanistic approach, something which was very much welcome in the Western world or secular world. We are talking about Islam, we are talking about Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt's viewpoints regarding human beings. Imam Khamenei also, on different occasions, tackled this issue. Sometimes I wish we have been created as the innocent babies and remain the babies for all our lives, okay? But this is not possible. But these potentials are given for the human beings, the prophets of Allah and the infallible Imams reached such a status in their lives that they could be called the men of God. Or
and
with this godly attributes. Okay.
A famous quote by Ayatollah Bajjat, the late Ayatollah Bajjat, rahmatullahi alayhi, when he said that the way and the path towards becoming a Salman is not closed. It's always open.
Salman, the companion of Prophet Muhammad.
Salman
right.
al-Muhammad.
Yes.
Yeah. Known as Salman al-Farsi.
Farsi, that's right.
So the way to become Salman is always open.
Yes.
But it's us. It's the turn of us to start to go towards becoming this Salman. So it has never been yet closed.
Yes.
So it depends on us to
Salman is a good
to
example.
Step in this way and reach to this.
Yeah. Ruzbeh from Isfahan, who migrated from his land, far, far lands, to Saudi Arabia, missed all that good weather in Isfahan in Iran, got to the hot
Arab Peninsula,
and converted to the religion of Islam and become one of the most important companions of Prophet Muhammad, considered from the Ahlul Bayt as it is considered in the speech of Prophet Muhammad. Okay, Sayyid Ayman, what's your take on that, brother? Talk a little bit about these main features of the human beings in the Islamic viewpoints. The human beings is the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as said, the viceroyal or the vicegerent. So considering this, he must have specific features or characteristics. What are they?
Yes, certainly. Human beings have been dignified, first of all, as a viceroy of God, as a successor of God on this earth to manage this place. And this itself is a very big, I think, honor for human beings. Second of all, as Quran Majid has said that, there is a asana taqweem. So there is a possibilities of, unlimited potential to achieve perfection.
Okay.
And then human beings are not only, just a physical being.
Yes.
They're also a spiritual being.
Yes.
So this spiritual part of them gives them opportunity to excel and progress, and to reach perfection.
That's right.
Human beings are also changeable. This is another trait of human beings. Mm-hmm. They can be changed.
Yes.
And this change is a key element for progress, because if something cannot be changed, it will be always jamid or stable or only remain in one condition. So human beings can change through, I think we talked about in the last episode, that they can be trainable. We can provide them good upbringing.
Yes.
And change human beings into either good human beings or bad ones.
Of course, even the animals can be educated and trained, but that training is not considered a spiritual wavering.
Yeah, it's limited.
That's right. This is the istidad, the talent that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put in the human being.
So the humans basically are, they have the trait of trainability or educability or corruptibility as well.
Oh.
In the both cases,
yes.
Either goodness
or evil.
Or evil.
And the 21st century, full of evils around us. How much we are busy with the evils, brother Ali, around us, and day by day, this fitra of the human beings is getting, but still the rays of hope are over there.
So we have always been in the hope of Allah's mercy, and we shall continue with this hope of us. And it has always actually helped us. And it is a cause of helping all the creatures of God, and all of us are in need of Allah's help and mercy, and we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to continue giving us whatever He knows
that's
is
right.
suiting us best.
Brother Ali, this tarbiyat paziri, or we can say the capacity to be